evening and welcome to a special joint edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You from Red River Radio. Tonight's program is made possible by the Knoll Foundation, the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and listeners like you. And tonight we will sound a bit different as we have both Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden in our studios, and we are not socially distancing tonight. They are with us tonight, although separated by wonderful plastic shielding. And Cliff Shackelford is currently the non-game statewide ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. And Dr. Beverly Burden is our resident entomologist here at Red River Radio and also an associate professor of biology and biological sciences at LSU Shreveport, a position she's held since 1995. Cliff and Beverly, welcome back.
Glad to be here, Bill.
Yeah, same here. And I'm glad the plexiglass is here because people can't see what happens on the radio, but we're constantly throwing things at each other. And so I'm glad we have the plexiglass because I'm tired of getting hit by her, you know, her water bottle squirting on me and throwing paper balls and stuff. So I'm just glad that we're protected.
Yeah, it's a heck of a job cleaning up the studio afterwards. So, all right, folks, you can call in tonight at 800-552-8502. I'll get that number correct. I've only said it 400,000 times. And you can call in with any question regarding birds or bugs tonight, or what birds will eat these bugs, or what bugs will get rid of these birds. So any question like that is legal game, I suppose. Snakes are out of limits. So anyway, well, no, some birds eat snakes, so what the heck. Yeah. Cliff, we ended your last Bird Calls program with a conservation note that also ties into insect and ecology. And could you talk a little bit about neonicotides?
Yeah. Neonics is the... it's kind of the reduced name, the smaller, easier name to remember than neonicotinoids. That's a very commonly used insecticide, first introduced in the U.S. in 94. It's a preemptive strike seed coating against keeping insects off of crops. And the problem with birds is that even just a few seeds or even a single seed with neonic is enough to either kill a songbird or impair it. There's been a study in a lab where they use white-crowned sparrows, which is a very widespread species in the U.S. Involved feeding tiny neonic-treated canola seeds to the sparrow, and it resulted in all of the birds in the study suffering significant impairment to orientation. They get lost, and that has a big part of migration, and this is a migratory species, so you don't want to be going the wrong way. And also a loss of up to 25% of their fat stores and body mass. And fat, you know, I've mentioned this before, fat's frowned upon in humans, but in birds, and I'm not talking about the Muscovy ducks and the white mallards that we feed at ponds in the urban parks. That's a different kind of fat. But birds in the wild that eat a lot of insects that build up fat stores, which is what powers flight, and it's basically them taking a lunch kit with them that they have subcutaneously on their body. And those fat stores, so a 25% reduction in this white-crowned sparrow study is significant if you're a migratory bird. And that fat is, you know, the fatty acids are oxidized and converted to metabolic water and thus virtually or essentially converted into energy. That's a big problem. So not only could it make the white-crowned sparrow orientation, thus direction, be wrong, it could also start off with a smaller gas tank that might not be able to make that flight. And also on fat reserves, we'll talk about this too, I'm sure, is that the winter storm that we're still talking about, the one they termed winter storm Uri that hit the South, including Texas and Louisiana, back in mid-February, you know, a lot of birds just couldn't get through it. They couldn't get through not having food available to them for extended periods, and so they burned up all their fat. So, but for the most part, Birds did fairly well in the storm, and they'd probably do okay with neonics, except in the study it indicates that there's a lot going on that we probably don't know enough about.
Now, neonics are used often. I remember a homebrew remedy years ago that somebody said take a half-smoked cigar, put it in a bottle of water, and let it literally steep outside in the sun for a couple of days, and you've got a good insecticide, you know, that you can spray around the base of your house and stuff. But, Beverly, is that a decent insecticide? And, again, remember what you're putting into the environment, a toxin.
Nicotine is in the class of chemicals called alkaloids, and they are naturally produced by the plant. They're called allelochemicals, or secondary plant compounds. Now, a tobacco plant has no need for nicotine as far as being able to grow and reproduce, but it is a naturally produced insecticide by the plant. And so neonicotinoids are a synthetic form of that. And most people know that nicotine is a nerve stimulant. That's why as well as caffeine, and that's why a lot of people used to get up in the morning, drink their coffee, have a cigarette, and they were buzzed and ready to go for the day. But the neonics are technically classified as not only a seed treatment, but also what we call a systemic, where you pour it into the soil and it's taken up into the roots, up into the trunk, the stems, the leaves, the flowers, and so it's spread throughout the plant. And that's why with insects, they will feed on all different types of the plant. And Cliff and I were talking earlier that something that needs to be stated here and understood from an ecological point of view, if you have a grasshopper that feeds on five plants that have taken up these neonics into its tissue, then that insecticide is concentrated five times in that grasshopper. And if you have a bird that comes along and eats five grasshoppers, then it's concentrated five times five. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we call biomagnification at each level. And so these things can accumulate in the ecosystem very fast. And so we do need to be very careful on what we're putting out there. And we should know what's going on, you know, the fate of it once we do put it out there. And luckily, we have a lot of good scientists and even citizen scientists that are observing these things. And you do need to be careful. And I think Cliff was going to actually talk about the potential effects of neonics on mammals.
Yes, and particularly our beloved pets, cats and dogs. There's a certain pet collar with a component imidacloprid, which is a neonic, that was shown to be fatal to cats and dogs. So people would buy this pet collar to keep ticks and other pests off them, and the pet collars resulted, wearing it results in seizures or even death in cats and dogs. So it's something to look for when you read the label, and thank goodness for labels, and thank goodness for being well informed to note what to avoid when we're treating our kids and our and feeding ourselves and feeding our pets and our dogs and cats and so forth. So we need to know more about neonics because there's some things pointing that have red flags that's not good.
And if you think about it, Cliff said that by federal law, insecticide companies are required to put what's called the active ingredient on the label. They do not have to put the inactive ingredient on the label, however. And most of the bottle sprays that you get to spray your flowers and some of your vegetation to protect them from insects, it will tell you most of them are going to be pyrethrins, and they'll always end in the suffix T-H-I-R-N. But if you're not sure what the active ingredient is, we all carry a computer now in our back pocket and in our purse. Take a moment, look it up.
Google it.
And educate yourself before you buy a product. Now, I'm not saying that all insecticides are bad. In fact, my particular research is to find naturally occurring insecticides like nicotine, like caffeine, like some of the other compounds that we have. But I'm just saying, educate yourself.
Yeah, that's right.
You are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton and Cliff Shackelford. And we can take your calls right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have our first caller online. Carolyn, you are on with Dr. Burton and Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Well, I have a question about the insects eating the neonics. Do they digest it and change the formula, break it down, or do they store it in their bodies? And then if the birds ate the insects, would it they get it in the birds' bodies and have the same effect?
It is very common for insects to do what we call sequestering away, and that's exactly what you described, that it's stored in their bodies, and so when the birds eat them, they'll be exposed to the same thing. Now, the thing about toxicology and toxins in general, there was an ancient Greek toxicologist called Paracelsus, and he goes, the poison is in the dose. And so it depends on how much the neonics that the insects or the birds are exposed to. It's all dose dependent. And so that's why your question is a little bit hard to answer. It depends on how many seeds the insects eat, how many plants the insects eat, how many of the grasshoppers the birds eat. But just be informed. And so, and some insects will just expel it out. And so if it's been a way to do things, insects have figured it out. I can tell you that right now. They employ all tools within their power.
That's why they've survived how many billion years? We're relative newcomers on this planet. So
that's right.
Okay. Well, I was just curious if the insects broke down or it stayed in the form.
Now, I'm not a toxicologist. Okay, I'm not a toxicologist, but I will tell you, especially with a lot of the pharmaceuticals that we as humans take, it's inactive until it is processed by the liver. And then once it's processed by the liver, then it becomes an active pharmaceutical for whatever ailment you're taking it for. Right. So that's kind of interesting.
But it's still dose dependent.
It is. Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
all
you
right,
for your call,
I
Carolyn.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
Right, thank you. And you can call in right now. We have all lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. This is a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton. And while we've got a lull here, we had a couple of pictures sent in to us. And Dr. Burton, the first one, it looks like, is that a honeybee nest or is it some other kind of bee nest?
I zoomed in and took a close look at it, and it's definitely Aphis mellifera. That's the honeybee. And a lot of people don't know that the honeybee is not native to the United States. It was brought into the Jamestown with the Jamestown colonists. But it's fared well with native honeybees, so we haven't had too much of a problem since back then. And this is a hive that's taken over a bird nest attached to a tree. And so I don't know how big of a problem it is with bees kicking birds out of their nest.
It's a man-made bird box.
Yeah.
And I've seen owl boxes. They have usually a larger mouth entrance, and I've seen this in the woods before. For example, in Smith Oaks in Jefferson County, Texas, there's a couple mm-hmm. bird boxes in the woods, and just the same mm-hmm. thing. And I've seen summer tanagers, which are notorious for eating bees, hanging around the box mm-hmm. and getting a couple sweet, yummy bites out of their a few of the honeybees that they've eaten.
Now there are things that you can build that are called bee boxes, and their openings are so narrow, it's almost like thinking about a large deck of cards where the cards are sparsely evenly placed, and so the birds can't get in there, but the bees can, and so that way it kind of divides the territories up.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're interested in doing native bees or even honeybees, build your bird boxes, but most importantly, plant native plants that the bees will pollinate.
Yeah. And the message with the bird box, if you do have an unwanted guest like a bee or red wasp, leave it alone. They're good to have. Get another box or build another box, because you can't expect putting out one of something and expecting it to work with the target you're seeking. So expect to maybe try two or three boxes, and maybe you'll get the bluebird in it that you want, or the screech owl, or whatever it is. So I'm guessing this is a screech owl box, but I can't really tell because the bees, the comb is coming out, bulging out of the hole, and completely shape-shifting the box itself. So pretty interesting.
Now, if you want to get rid of these bees, of course, there are beekeepers around that can do that for you. So you can call them. You don't want to necessarily destroy the bees because they are pollinators, and that's a key point right now, is we need all the pollinators we can get.
That's right. That's right. And our food depends on pollinators. So if we like coffee, we like tea, there's several tons of vegetables and fruits that are all dependent on pollinators. So if you like to eat, you need to appreciate pollination and pollinators that do it.
Well, I like to eat, so don't mess with them.
Well, and I read an article. They don't know how this ever got started or how it was ever even substantiated. But we've always been told, at least people like Cliff and I that are in the business, so to say, that every one out of every 10 bites of food is due to a pollinator. Have you heard that, Cliff?
It's one out of three is what I've heard.
Okay, more. And
that's not the whole thing you're biting, but there's an ingredient
like
therein that was some kind of a fruit or vegetable or that was pollinated. You know, chocolate. If it wasn't for the chocolate midge in the cacao tree, we wouldn't have our beloved chocolate. So thanks to an insect for pollinating the cacao tree that we so love in our Hershey's and other chocolate. So,
and if you do have a bee nest where you don't want to have it, I know you can probably call the Texas Agricultural Extension Agency. I know the Louisiana Agricultural Extension and Forest Agency. They have a list of beekeepers that will volunteer to come out and remove that nest for you.
Yeah, they can create a new hive and take it out and make some money off of it, making honey.
Yeah, do a little homework, because I've had to do that in a family property, and it's not a free service.
It's not, okay.
No, the beekeepers are so overwhelmed, they have to charge. And then if it's in a structure of yours, like the side of a house, they're going to have to do some cutting, and guess what? They're not going to repair it.
No, no.
So if you got them in the side of the, in the eave of a house, as in the case that we had, they're going to cut into it. They have to get the queen, to get the hive out of there, and then you're going to be left with the carpentry bills afterwards. Mm-hmm. So it's not cheap, but you can't have those bees if it's on the side of your house and you're raising children. You don't want to tell your kids to not go on that side of the house, and heaven forbid telling kids not to go outside.
Or have a ton of honey stuck in your walls.
Right.
You know.
So. Right. So we want to encourage children to get outside and enjoy nature and appreciate it, not be so scared of it. And worry about bees and snakes and spiders and all that. That's, you know, there's so much more you can get out of being outside, and our kids can get out of being outside, that it's just super beneficial that we promote nature to our children.
Absolutely.
You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call just like that person did at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You'll get right in right now. Now, Cliff, I'd read a story on NPR, actually, heard the story about bird feeders possibly spreading salmonella that's killing thousands of finches. Is this a problem that we have discovered? Is it something old that's just cropping up again? What's going on here?
This winter has been a problem in many states, six or eight states for sure, have reported problems in salmonella. Washington, Oregon, California were some of the first states pre-New Year's. And so Texas has had problems in the last 6 or 8 weeks with pine siskins. And the testing that has been done so far by Parks and Wildlife, we don't actually do the testing. We have to ship it off to labs that do the work. You know, think about the lab technician in the white robe, the white coat, they're doing that stuff for us. And it's not been very conclusive with the few specimens that we have sent in from Texas. But the rest of the country, And part of it is social media. So social media is spreading it faster than it got to Texas that, hey, salmonella is killing pine siskins. And that might be the case. But here's the take-home message. It doesn't matter what is killing the siskins. What's happening is they are spreading it at super spreader event sites, which are our feeders mm-hmm. and our bird baths. So the take-home message is don't host a super spreader event. And so as soon as you see a sickly or dead siskin or goldfinch or any other bird at your feeder, shut it down. Same with the bath. Shut it down, because guess what that sick bird is going to do? It's going to infect other birds that come in there. So don't be the host of a super spreader event. We have to remember that birds did just fine without us for millennia. Feeding birds has not been happening for centuries, but birds have been around for hundreds and hundreds of centuries doing fine without feeders. So remember that it is supplemental what we're doing in our feeders. It's not sustenance. So a lot of people are taking this to heart saying, well, I can't shut my feeder down. The birds will die of starvation. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
And so instead, don't increase the number of deaths by doing it through kindness. Don't think, well, I'm being kind feeding the birds, but in turn, you're actually including a lot of new deaths because of the super spreader event. And that's a word, gosh, we never used before COVID. I think everybody now should know what a super spreader event or a super spreader site is, thanks to COVID.
So in this case, it's actually the bird coming in sick and passing on the infection through the bird feeder, rather than something happening in the bird feeder that is generating salmonella.
Correct. The sick bird brings it in and poops or salivates onto the feeder or the food, and another bird comes in and is exposed to it. And then it keeps passing it on. And so in nature, siskins are not going to be as concentrated coming to that one tube feeder like we have hanging by our window. Instead, they're up in the canopy, they're spread out more, and they're less likely to come in contact with one another like they are at a feeder. Because at a feeder, you might have three or four ports, and that means every bird is going to sit there and stick their head in that one spot where some sick bird has already been. Mm-hmm.
You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any question regarding birds, the avian world, or insects, both fiendish and friendly, are welcome. And we have all lines open right now. And so we're going to go on to another picture that was sent in of an owie. If you look on our website and look for the post for this show, you're going to see a sore spot on an up-close picture of a sore spot. Jill sent this in of a bug bite. And Dr. Burden, give us a clue about this.
Well, first, let me add the disclaimer. I'm a PhD, not an MD, but I've seen enough of this to pretty much know what's going on here. Ticks, when they bite, they do not do like mosquitoes do. They don't stick a clean needle down into the tissue and start to suck blood. A tick mouth part is called a hyperstome, and it's like a large rod, and it has these recurved bristles on it. And so if you try to pull it out, it's going against the bristles, and that's why it's so hard to take out ticks. And you can see from this wound, it has a center that would be where the hyperstome was stuck in. It's starting to have an inflamed red area around it. It almost looks a little white, opaqueish around that. So this is a classic tick bite, and it could eventually perhaps be associated with Lyme disease, because the key diagnostic for Lyme disease is known as a bullseye center, a bullseye rash. But like I tell my students, if we wait until the bullseye rash fully develops without getting clinical assistance, then you're not doing anybody any favors. And so if you think that you might have been exposed to something with Lyme disease, definitely go to the clinic, keep it clean, put, for the sake of everything, put antibiotic cream on it. It's not going to hurt. And but don't wait until it's too long. With most insect wounds, they're going to have a more defined, tight center, and normally there's going to be some type of swelling involved as well, because they're inserting their saliva into your tissue, and that's why mosquitoes can transmit so many diseases, because that saliva might contain a virus, a bacteria, or even a protozoan. And ticks do the same thing, but not to the extent that mosquitoes do.
I've got a question. Where's the tick? I mean,
it's gone.
It's amazing to me, because every time I've gotten a tick, I feel it. Poking at it, it's irritating me.
Yeah,
and I mean, there's occasion on the middle of my back in college. I remember I had one. I was living in a dormitory, 19 years old, and I finally asked my roommate, "Hey, what's this thing that's biting?" And it was a tick that had a blood sac, and he had been there a while. But I guess they eventually fall off.
If they had a blood sac, it would have been a female.
Okay,
it's only the females that engorge. The males do not, because the female needs that extra protein to produce her clutch of eggs.
Okay.
And what was the original question?
The original question was, where is he? I guess he did his business and he fell off?
Yeah, that's what they'll do.
Yeah, I guess I've never let them do that.
Hang on. And ticks are amazing animals. They actually have CO2, the front legs at the end of them and the tarsal segments. They have things that are called howlers, H-A-L-L organs, that are actually CO2 sensors. And so they'll hang upside down on a piece of plant or a branch and wave their front legs in the air, and they're sensing the CO2. And when you walk by, the CO2 levels increase, and they just jump in that direction.
That's amazing.
So that's why when I walk through the woods, you can see them falling out of, you can literally, put a white hat out and walk through the woods, and you're going to find a couple of ticks in that white hat.
If it's heavily enough infestation. Yeah. What people that collect ticks for research do is they will take an old wooden crate and drag it along, and they'll have dry ice in that wooden crate.
Oh.
And as the wooden crate passes along, CO2 sensors go way up, and they jump on the dry ice, immediately preserved.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Cool.
I know. Let Hollywood come up with something like this.
Yeah, what a movie that would make if ticks were a little bigger, like cat-sized.
Yeah, and you could just collect them walking down the road with some dry ice.
Yeah.
Coming soon to a theater near you. So, you are listening to a joint episode of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burden. And we have lines open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We go next to Jim from Lufkin. Jim, what's your question tonight?
Hi, Cliff. I was just wondering what kind of owl box will work best in East Texas.
Well, we have in East Texas and in western Louisiana, we have three species of woodland owl, and only two of those will use a nest box. The screech owl, which is the bird's the size of a 12-ounce soda can, and the barred owl, which is roughly the size of an NFL football. So the box for the screech owl is a lot easier to build, and more importantly, to get on a ladder and hold it so you can fasten it to a tree, because a barred owl box is pretty doggone big. It's almost the size of a dorm refrigerator. I've seen some that are smaller than that, but they need to be pretty darn big. The third woodland owl we have is the great horned, and they don't use a box. They're typically looking for old abandoned raptor nests or raven nests where ravens occur in our area. Crows, they like old great blue heron nests, for example. So the great horned owl looks for old stick nests, platform nests, and use those. Sometimes they'll use a tree that has topped and there's just the hollow that's pointing to the sky. That's not the same thing as a cavity, in my opinion, like the screech owl cavity and the barred owl cavity. Those two are more like a woodpecker cavity with a horizontal entrance, and then you go vertically down into the bottom. Well, the great horned in the top tree is just a big open chimney-like thing where it can nest in there. So, and then outside of our woodland areas, you know, you can get into prairie country and there'll be barn owls. So the earlier owl I mentioned is barred, B-A-R-R-E-D, and that's the woodland one I mentioned that needs the dorm size refrigerator box. The barn, B-A-R-N, owl is going to be an open prairie or open ag land bird, and those also use boxes as well. So the answer is depends on if you're in the woods or in the prairie.
In the piney woods.
And if you're in the piney woods, then I would go with the screech owl. There's lots of blueprints available online to build all these kinds of boxes. So you can do it yourself for anything you want. If you like bluebirds, wood ducks, or screech owls, you can look online and find blueprints and make it yourself.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim.
Now, Cliff, I've also heard that if you have the acreage and if you have a dead tree on your property and it's not a threat to your house or garage or shed, leave it be.
Great point. Yeah, dead trees, what we say is let dead trees live. A buddy of mine, Greg Grant, he loves saying that one, and I've picked up on that one, and it is true. They still have a lot of life. So the dead wood can be, you know, that's a bad word in the workplace, dead wood. They're always wanting to get those people to retire, right? But dead wood out in the field is really great, out in the woods, because then the woodpeckers can come and excavate a cavity that they'll use. And then when they're done with it, there are a lot of species that need a cavity, wood duck, for example, tree squirrels, lots of other birds that are looking for an old abandoned woodpecker cavity, and often that's in a dead tree. So yeah, like Dr. Burton said, if you've got a dead tree on the property and it's not going to fall on anything of value, then leave it be. And it's also a great place for raptors to land. So you might see a barred owl sitting on the snag, or a red-shouldered hawk, and it's just a great opportunity to see wildlife. So let dead trees live.
Now, it's also a place that could house termites too, Dr. Burton, and you don't necessarily want those close to your house, but I'd rather have them eat a tree than my house.
Yeah, it's just part of the ecosystem. They're resilient. They're advantageous. They'll take whatever they can. The wet termites, they have to maintain contact with the soil. The dampwood termites, they have to maintain contact with the soil. They love old trees, especially if they're no longer vertical, that they're more horizontal. Mm-hmm. They've fallen, but it also harbors a dead tree is an ecosystem within itself.
Oh yeah.
One of the things that I give my entomology students is I teach them to go take and get an old upholstery knife, and that's a wonderful tool to start digging into dead trees. You'll find ants in there. You'll find these big black patent leather beetles called best beetles in there, Pisalidae, and they're kind of they're very close to the cockroaches. The fact that when you find one, you normally find several. They're not social, truly social, but they do aggregate, and we've uncovered a lot of cool things in dead trees. Like I said, it's an ecosystem within itself. So when the birds get through with it, the insects can come in and benefit it as well.
And the fungi love it too.
That's right.
And a lot of the woodpeckers are excavating in the dead wood because they're after the larval stage of those, like the Bessie bug you mentioned, and other species, Elaterids and Buprestids that are laying eggs in the tree that are helping decompose that tree or getting value out of it. The woodpeckers are coming in and eating on them. So, yeah, you're right. There's a whole ecosystem going on in a dead tree.
Well, not in our culture. I listened to a Pulse of the Planet for next week about a culture that does eat termites. They fry them up in a pan and eat them, but they couldn't imagine us eating frog legs.
Exactly. In fact, it's called entomophagy, the process of eating insects for nutrition. And right now, North America and Europe are the only two places worldwide that have an appulsion, that think eating insects is just really terrible. But they're actually very high in protein, low in cholesterol, and people had been mass rearing crickets for years to for food sources for birds and other things.
You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now. All lines are open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. So speaking of insect culinary delights, we have brood X of cicadas coming up. Is there a good recipe out there for cicadas?
Well, the adults know. Most, there are some cultures that will eat adults, but most will eat immatures, especially grubs, and also the immatures of wasps. I've had them, the best way I've ever had them is you take and you saute them in a little olive oil and then just sprinkle them with some kind of seasoning. And you don't want to fry them hard. You just want to kind of do it kind of like a egg roll. Mm-hmm. And I've had the wasp larvae that way. And they kind of have a crunchy, nutty pop to them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, people have been eating insects in many, many cultures for many, many years. And so there's nothing wrong with that. But if you're talking about brood X, that refers to cicadas, what people in the South will call locusts. And in fact, that's why sometimes we do call them locusts, but I'll get to that in a minute. Brood X, there are about 15 broods of cicadas that their immatures live under the ground for an extensive number of years, either 13 years or 17 years. The cicadas that we have here in the Arklatex, excluding perhaps some areas of south east Oklahoma, we don't have the 17-year or the 13-year. We have what we call the periodical cicadas that they come out annually, every year. But this year, Brood X, Brood 10, because they always use the Roman numerals, so X is 10. They're going to be coming out from New York west to Illinois, south into the northern Georgia area. They tend to be very, very smaller than our regular periodical cicadas. And especially the ones out in southwest Oklahoma that I've seen, they have these brilliant red eyes. And it's just part of their nature. And nobody knows why they do it. They just do it that way.
Okay, so they're going to be... but when you say coming out, I mean they're going to come out in mass.
Yeah, they do have to come out in mass because they have to synchronize their mating. Okay. You know, if one group... If all the males hatched one week and the females hatched the other week, then that, there goes that generation. Mm. And so you have to synchronize the emergence. And that's why they're called... that's why they're called locusts, because people compared them to the locust swarms of grasshoppers in the Middle East and in Africa, China. We used to have some grasshoppers that were considered to be locust migratory grasshoppers in the West, but we haven't seen those for a long time.
The Rocky Mountain?
Yeah.
The one they call the Rocky Mountain locust. Yeah. They're gone.
The last time I heard of locust here in the U.S. was really the Dust Bowl era, isn't it?
But now all we have are the cicadas, the 17-year, the 15-year, and then our annuals. But what I'm looking for this year, because it's been really, really wet, and one thing that people don't realize much about water, it takes a lot of change in air temperature to change the temperature of water. And I'm wondering what the mayfly population is going to look like this spring as they start coming out. That's a pretty good source of nutrition for birds, is it?
Absolutely. And cicadas, too, I was going to mention. There are a lot of birds, including raptors, especially raptors, that feast on cicadas. The Mississippi kites that we are very familiar with in the
We should start seeing them soon.
Yep, they'll be coming back any minute, and they're going to hit the cicadas. I've seen broad-winged hawks go after cicadas in the canopy, blue jays, and the most famous one of all is the cicada killer, the vespid. Did you want to mention anything about the wasp?
Yeah, the largest hornet-like insect that we have here in the Arklatex is called the cicada killer. These things can be up to 2 inches in length, and they excavate the soil, not directly down, but they come in at an angle, like about a 30-degree angle, and they excavate the soil, and then they'll go find them a cicada, and they will paralyze it, and then they'll take it to their hole. And I love watching these things fly with a cicada in tow, because the cicada is as big as they are.
Yeah.
And it looks like, you know, a B-52 coming in, you know, with its wings going back and forth, and you don't know if it's going to safely land or not. And then all of a sudden it touched down, it drags it in there, and it lays an egg on the locust, the cicada. And then basically the cicada isn't dead, but it's eventually eaten alive by the little grub of the cicada killer.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Another good Hollywood story.
Yeah.
You know, and based on true events. Not these made up things that we come up with. These are real things,
and they're a very important part of the urban ecosystem. Every once in a while, we will have a significant number of cicada killers on our LSUS campus, and people will start emailing like, "Whatever you do, don't go over to the northwest corner of such and such hall because there's these killer hornets over there." And I just think, oh God, not again. but our safety guy on campus, he keeps my emails that I send out like that. So he goes, okay, it's time to send out Burden's comments on, you know, cicada killers. That they're not aggressive at all.
No.
I've stood in the middle of, you know, a half a dozen of them swarming all around.
They could care less about humans.
Yeah, they just want their cicadas, and they want to drag them down in their hole.
And the best way to spot one is to have your ears on. Because all of a sudden you'll hear one of those cicadas just squealing and coming down from the tree because he's got a cicada killer attached to him that's stinging him. So that's how you can find this whole interaction, is to hear one screaming, you know, "Let me go!" And it is pretty neat. So like you said, it's like a B-52 carrying a 747.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing that they can,
maneuver.
That it works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to see Hollywood come up with a giant cicada.
Yeah.
Claymation. You are listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls with Dr. Beverly Burden and Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call right now. We have all lines open at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. I'm surprised we're not getting more calls tonight, but we have some other stuff to talk about. Back a while ago, I saw an article about the government making it illegal again to accidentally kill any native species of songbirds. Can you tell us what this is about, and why would we want to protect songbirds?
Yeah, native birds. So we can't knowingly and unknowingly damage protected native species, which is most of our birds. And so the oil spill, the Deep Horizon oil spill, that was probably the most historical event where it impacted birds, and BP was expected to pay restitution to deal with that. And so the Trump administration tried to relax that. They did for a temporary period of time, but the Biden administration has brought that back because there's just too many things that we do that would eliminate a lot of our wildlife, including our native birds that are working for us. And we've mentioned this on the show that birds are working for us and we don't even know it. They're doing what we call ecosystem services, like keeping rodent numbers in check, keeping insect numbers in check. The industry of wildlife watching and nature tourism and bird watching in Texas is a $13.8 billion with a B per year industry. So bird watching is something we need, and birds are part of that. So we've got to protect them. We can't just run amok and mess things up for nature.
You're listening to a joint episode of What's Bugging You and Bird Calls, and you can give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open, and any questions are welcome. And I do have a question here. You know, as mosquito season comes along and, you know, the insects start pouring out, and what is the best, I guess, ecological natural defense against mosquitoes in the avian world and in the insect world? How can we create a backyard environment where the mosquitoes are actually destroyed by other things that we want to have around?
Well, first of all, the standing water. You know, drain any standing water. Instead of just spraying insecticide for the sake of spraying insecticide, it would be better that you would treat yourself and not the environment. Because go ahead and get some DEET and wear it. There's some other alternatives to DEET. There's a geranol that's a plant oil from rose and citronella. There's an oil that's from black pepper plants called Picardium. And treat yourself. Be mindful of when you're out in the environment. You know, dusk, dawn, that's a lot of times when the insects are going to be feeding the most. If you have standing water like a pond, use your little mosquito BT donuts that will release natural insecticide out into the water that won't be harmful to the fish or any amphibians or mammals. And so I call it the common sense manner and treat yourself and not the environment.
Yeah, and she nailed it. It's the standing water. It's a human issue. It's a man-made issue. If we have inflated mosquitoes in our neighborhood, it's because of things that we are doing. Maybe not you, but your neighbors are. So your next-door neighbor in a typical urban environment is important to you because mosquitoes can travel easily a door or two away. So just half a cup, coffee cup of water can do it. So we've got to clean our gutters. We've got to make sure if we have things that are capturing water, like old tires in the yard, or you've got a potted plant and you've got a saucer under it collecting water. All these things are mosquito breeders that we are unknowingly doing and creating the problem. So inflated numbers of mosquitoes are because of what we as humans are doing.
Now, as far as actual insects that eat mosquitoes, dragonflies, I understand, are a good source of a good eater of mosquitoes.
They're going to eat mosquitoes, but not to the level that it's going to bring the population down so much that they cannot be a pest to humans. You know, there's checks and balances in nature. If dragonflies were going to decimate the populations of mosquitoes, they would have done so hundreds of years ago.
So
Cliff and I, as always, are on the same page. Also, dress appropriately. If you wear lighter colored clothing, you're more likely to spot a mosquito resting on your clothes rather than if you're wearing a dark shirt or a dark pair of pants. And so just talking about opening the doors, make sure that your doors are and windows are screened and sealed properly so they can't come inside. And that's what you can do.
Now, how about mosquito hawks?
Mosquito hawks are called crane flies, not to be confused with another group of flies that are actually supposed to be called crane flies. Mm-hmm. Those are in the order Mecoptera. But mosquito hawks are neither mosquitoes nor hawks, nor do they eat mosquitoes. Okay? That's the best thing I can say. They are both the immatures and the adults are scavengers.
The most inappropriately named insect out there?
Yeah. I guess people thought that since it looked like a big mosquito, it might eat mosquitoes. But they're scavengers. So best leave those alone. They're, again, just part of the natural system. When Wally and I first moved to Shreveport, he had a cat named Sydney. And he used to love to corner these in a corner of a room where you would have a door closed, and you'd go to shut the door, and it would just be wings and legs, a big pile of them back there. And so, that's the story on mosquito hawks.
So get a cat for the mosquito hawks.
It might work.
You are listening to What's Bugging You and Bird Calls, a joint episode, and you can call in now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Jeff from Cotton Valley, you are on with Cliff and Dr. Burden. What's your question?
I was wondering, what's the best way to get rid of fire ants in and around my house without using pesticides?
That's a tough one, Cliff. Jeff. I do use a pesticide. It's an acetate pesticide. and a little bit goes a long ways. Whatever you do, please don't set fire to it. That's going to cause more problems than it's going to solve. A lot of people will take and blast them out with water. I've tried this a couple times, and it actually works. They get disturbed so many times. You don't kill them out, but they just get disturbed. Now, if you do kill out a mound, a lot of people say, well, if you do, they'll just move to some other place. Well, that's not the case. What you don't see in your yard is there'll be one primary mound and then several secondary mounds that are being suppressed by the larger colony. And so if you do kill out the larger colony, then these other colonies are going to pop up because they're no longer being suppressed by the mother colony, I guess you could say it. And so that, if you want to use acephate, that works the best. It's pretty non-toxic to the environment. But don't set fire to it. That's what a lot of people do, and that's, you can't do that. Cliff?
And this is the red imported fire ant we're talking about, the non-native that was introduced from Brazil decades ago. It crawled onto ships. It got into packaging. They're still hitchhiking today. You can go to the store and go into the nursery section, buy a potted plant, and it came from far away, and there's a fire ant mound inside of it that you quickly discover as you're carrying the pot with you. So this is a big issue that's, you know, they've pretty much maxed out going north. The cold weather has, they've gone as far north as they can with cold. They've gone about as far west as they can with drought. They don't do well in the desert. Now, of course, urban areas, we can create more moist conditions with our leaky spigots and sprinklers and whatnot, but it's a southeastern U.S. thing. So if you're listening in Duluth or Portland, Maine, be glad you don't have red imported fire ants, because they are a problem.
Your winters are actually a blessing in disguise in that sense. Now, I had an observation. We had a nest forming out in the cracks of the fire, the sidewalks, as we do every year here recently. And, you know, I just took my foot and swiped across the top of it and moved all the sand across. And, of course, they came pouring out. The next day, that nest was right back. I mean, they built that thing up overnight. And I did it again. And then the next day, I noticed it wasn't built back. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, there was a little bit of one. I did it again. And now it's just the remnants of what used to be a nest. There's just dirt there. They obviously are smarter than those who live on the coast and suffer hurricanes every year, because I think they just decided this is a bad neighborhood.
Yeah, it is a disturbance factor, and that's what I've discovered. And I have another theory that I'd like to put a graduate student on, and that is fire ants. You'll find fire ants built around structures and trees more often than you will find fire ants in an open field. And I think it's because they're using the conductive heat off of those trees and sidewalks and other obstacles. I always have a big fire ant mound right around my bird feeder because it's concrete, and they're attracted to that warmth. And I'm not sure what to take from that, but a little bit of analysis and data gathering would certainly prove me right.
You are listening to Bird Calls and What's Bugging You, a joint episode with Cliff Shackelford and Dr. Beverly Burton. And we still have lines open right now. Time for a little more questions. 800-552-8502. Jan from Shreveport is up next. Jan, what's your question?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. So I am curious about the chemical that's being used by our spray trucks in the city of Shreveport. And if that is in fact impacting beneficial insects as well. You can call and be put on the no spray list, which is something that I have done in years past, partly because I've got a vegetable garden in the front yard and I don't want it sprayed. But I'm just curious about what the latest is on that, and if you think that that is an effective means of controlling mosquitoes, and if the city's applying it properly at the right time of day and all that kind of stuff.
I've known several people that have worked for that department in Shreveport, and Both of them very good trained biologists. It is effective, but minimally so. The major chemical that they're spraying is called a pyrethrin that is pretty safe for vertebrates, anything with a backbone, and it will take out mosquitoes, but primarily only if it's in high enough concentration. And that's why I say it's minimally effective. But you know what? There's two groups of people out there, Jan. One group are like you that's saying, I don't want any chemicals sprayed in my environment that I don't need to. And then there's the other group that says, come over here and spray. These mosquitoes are eating us up. And some people, it gives them a sense of wellness, security, to know that the truck's going by there killing the mosquitoes. And so if it was causing, we've been spraying, those trucks have been around spraying for close to 100 years. And if it was bad, we would know it by now. And that's why I say it's minimally effective, because it's such a low dose.
Yeah, and if it's killing non-target insects, remember about half of our birds are insectivorous, and they need insects. So we need to let the birds do their job.
Uh-huh.
And again, if you're overrun with mosquitoes, it's something you or your neighbors are doing, and you can fix it in short order, and you don't need chemical spray to do it. You just have to be vigilant. And that means cleaning your gutters. And if it rains again and it's fall or winter and the leaves are falling, guess what? Your gutters are going to get clogged again. Gutters, I've said this before, I have a love-hate relationship with my gutters on my house. Mm-hmm. I need them to keep water away from the wood, away from the foundation, but I hate them because they get clogged with leaves. And those leaf guards do not work, in my opinion. It just traps the leaves and pine straw on top, and then you still have to brush them off. But a lot of people have gutters, and they're not tending to them, and they get clogged up, and it holds water, believe it or not, and it can hold water for a long time. And mosquitoes don't need a long time to get a life cycle out and spit out, and then they're already hitting you, and it's an issue. So it's a man-made thing, and we can do our part in our backyard and talk to neighbors and get them to clean their gutters. You know, it's a great job if you've got a teenager. I've got a teenager in the house. He's always looking for work. He just got a car in the last couple of months. He needs gas money. You might have a neighbor like that where you can hire somebody and promote that kid to clean the gutters in the neighborhood and make it mosquito-free.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks, Jan.
All right. Thank you, Jan. And just one final question for Dr. Burton quickly. What was the effect of the ice storm, do you think, on the bug population? Was that severe enough to have an effect, or was that just an annoyance?
Insects have a special chemical in their blood that's very similar to ethylene glycol, the active chemical in antifreeze. So their blood doesn't freeze. And since we got a snow first and then the ice, that snow actually acted as an insulating layer. And so, if it did have any negative impact, it would be very little. And B, they bounce back so fast that it's not even going to be a noticeable incident.
All right. Well, I want to thank both of you for joining us again for another joint edition.
Fourth annual.
Yeah. There you go.
High-fiving it over here.
You will be able to join us next month for both Bird Calls and What's Bugging You in that month. So thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Bill.
And I want to thank Cliff. This is actually his Tuesday and his hour for having me on as his guest.
Well, and we are so glad that you could be our guest, because birds and bees belong together. Birds and bugs, they have everything to do with each other. So thank you so much.
All right. You have been listening to a special edition of Bird Calls and What's Bugging You with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist, and Dr. Beverly Burton, our resident entomologist. Dr. Burton is the resident entomologist and associate professor of biological sciences at LSUS, and Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. Tune in next month for Bird Calls on Tuesday, May 11th, and the next edition of What's Bugging You on Tuesday, May 18th. And thank you so much for joining us tonight. This program was produced by Bill Beckett, Cliff Shackelford, and Dr. Beverly Burden, with help from Wally Derleth and Sheila Lawrence. Radio Lab is next.